And we're live. All right. Paul, well, first of all, welcome. Thank you for coming here. And you are probably one of the most requested people from the internet that I've ever had. So feel good about that.
I'm honored.
And you're the first guy ever to wear a mushroom hat.
Okay.
That's really a hat made out of mushrooms?
Yeah, it's made from this Amadou mushroom. It's called Phomias fomentarius. It grows on birch trees throughout the world. But this is an example of why I think shamanistically plants, mushrooms become significant. There's a plurality of benefits. So this mushroom is a fire starter mushroom. It allowed for the portability of fire. There's no doubt that we came from Africa. We migrated north. We discovered something new called winter. Oops. This allowed for the portability of fire. You can hollow this mushroom out, put embers of a fire inside, and carry fire for days. If your clan could not rekindle fire in Europe in the wintertime, you would die. So when you – this hat is actually made by some ladies in Transylvania.
Can I feel that?
Yeah. And it's a hardwood conch.
Oh, wow.
But when you soak it in lye water, you know, ashes and water, it delaminates into this fabric.
Whoa, let me feel that.
It's very soft. It's also called German felt.
Wow.
It's extremely flammable. So it revolutionized warfare because during the Napoleonic times, this is the punk that ignited gunpowder.
Really?
So even the Chinese invented, you know, the Chinese invented gunpowder, the Europeans invented the rifle. So this allowed flint spark guns to ignite the gunpowder.
This feels amazing.
It is.
It's How big a piece can you get?
That's a great question. Depending on the size of the conch. On beech trees, they're much bigger than birch. Beech trees just naturally get larger. So the larger the conch, the more fabric you can tear. But this mushroom is made of mycelium. And basically, that fabric is a cellular fabric called mycelium. And this is – I have one that caught on fire because somebody was smoking a joint near me. And the embers of the joint got on my hat.
Did it just immediately go up?
No, it burns really slowly. So it's a fuse.
Oh.
It's fantastic for delayed explosions. It's because you can light this thing. And beekeepers for hundreds of years use this for smoking the hives of bees.
Oh.
And because it's just – we could light it now. I mean, the whole thing would – one flick of the Bic and this thing will smoke entirely in about 10 minutes and turn nothing into white ash.
Wow.
Your fire alarms may go off, though.
Yeah, so, probably.
Yeah.
So. And so with this thing, this larger piece, they would hollow this out, put an ember in there. Would they have to blow on the ember as they hiked?
Well, you could blow on a little bit and you cap it, and then you can put it in your pocket. The famous Iceman that was found on the border of Italy and Austria, he had this tethered to his right side, which is a position of significance, you know, things that you need, like your knife, you know, and things that you want to make sure you have if you're right-handed, it's on the right side. So this one example of it, we have a thread of knowledge of use of mushrooms that goes over millennia, and most of those threads have been frayed or broken in the chain of knowledge. But this is one of the threads that was not broken, and it's significant, I think. We were much more dependent upon mushrooms when we were forest people than we are now seemingly in the cities, but it's coming full circle very quickly.
Well, mushrooms are weird in that some of them are incredibly edible and nutritious, and other ones will kill you. And sometimes they look really similar to each other.
Well, this is the mystery of mushrooms, and I think it speaks to also mycophobia, the fear of mushrooms. R. Gordon Wasson first coined that term. But when you think about it, in your visual landscape with animals, you see them for months, years, and plants. So you have a familiarity factor. But mushrooms that come up and disappear in 4 or 5 days, some of them can feed you, some can kill you, some can heal you, some can send you on a spiritual journey. So to have something so powerful and yet so ephemeral, it's natural for humans to avoid that which they don't understand out of fear because they don't know the difference. But, you know, 23 primates consume mushrooms, humans being one of them. And so that speaks to a long ancestral use of mushrooms going back, you know, in our primate evolutionary tree for a very, very long time.
How many species of mushrooms are there?
You know, you asked me that question 5 years ago. I would have said 1.5 million. And now we're up to about 5 million is being estimated.
Whoa. You know,
fungi outnumber plants 5 to 10 to 1. I speak at TED, and I've gone to these TED conferences, but it's shocking. With the smartest brains in the world, not until just recently did they realize what us mycologists have known for a long time. 30% of the soil mass, when you're walking on soil, the 30% of the biological carbon is fungal. And the biggest...
Whoa. Say that again. 30%.
30% of soil is fungal mass, living and dead, of healthy soil. So, and this is the biggest repository of carbon in the world.
Wow.
In the ground is related to these fungal networks. So there is about 8.3 to about 10 million species on the planet. About right now, about half of those are fungal species. They outnumber plants up to 8 to 1, 10 to 1 by some estimates. Really nice, interesting metric. And 1 meter of a tree root, for every meter of a tree root, there's a kilometer of mycelium. Now think of that. 3 feet versus 2,200 feet. So that the extensiveness of the mycelial network in our landscapes is vast. And I call it Earth's natural internet. These are membranes that are literally sensitive. I think they're sentient. They respond to every footprint that we take on this planet. And as you walk across landscapes, you're breaking wood, and that makes new nutrition available. So the competition of fungi to find that new nutrition is fierce. And so first to the menu wins. So this is something that we are now understanding how essential they are for preserving biodiversity and for the health of the ecosystems as well as our own personal health.
So when you say you think they're sentient, to what degree? I mean, and you're not talking about just like psilocybin, Amanita muscaria.
We're kind of intellectually provincial in that we are using language and invented terms in order to describe concepts that we're struggling with. So let me describe it this way, that we separated from fungi 650 million years ago.
Maybe you did, dude. I know some people that are probably still.
Well, basically, we are descendants of fungi.
Yeah.
We share a more common ancestry with fungi than we do with any other kingdom.
And fungi are closer to animals than they are to plants.
Animals came from fungi. Whoa. You and I are actually fungal bodies. Oof. I'm speaking to basically another fungal body right now. So Joe Rogan, I mean, whether you know it or not, you're basically a fungal mass.
Okay.
And from a cellular point of view, under the microscope, human cells, animal cells, and fungal cells are very, very similar. We exhale carbon dioxide. We inhale oxygen.
As do fungus.
As the fungus does. We separated from fungi, basically. We chose the route to encapsulate our nutrients in a cellular sac, a stomach, digesting our nutrients within. The fungal systems digest their nutrients externally. They exhale oxygen, inhale carbon dioxide. And their network-like design allows them to respond to catastrophia. And what I mean by that is that the mycelial networks, they're so dense in the soil, and they have literally hundreds of billions of tips. And as these tips are growing out, they tend to be polynucleate at the tips. And it allows them to upregulate new enzymes, acid sequences, et cetera. So if there's a new ecological challenge, a new food source, a new toxin or something, these fungal networks are so have great plasticity in being able to code for new sequences from their DNA. So all you need is one of those hundreds of billions of tips to find a new enzyme to break down a toxin or a new food source. And what happens then is that information then is incorporated genetically into the mycelial network, and the mycelium then surges because it has new food, logically. And so when it surges and it creates a new, what's it called, a sector of mycelium, we now know there's evidence that the mycelial network then that it benefits from that tip exploration and discovery. So these are like massively resilient, adaptive organisms that have a network-based design, not dissimilar from that of our neural networks, not dissimilar from the computer internet. And more that I explore this, the more I'm convinced that we will find network-based organisms throughout the cosmos, probably fungal systems. And fungal systems ultimately give rise, in our case, animals. And it's more likely we'll find fungal-animal relationships all throughout the universe.
Do you think that there's some unknown way that animals are connected in some sort of a similar way as well? That if animals came from fungus, and fungus has this incredible way of communicating with each other, do you think that there's something like that in the animal kingdom that we haven't discovered?
Well, that stimulates my thought into talking about the microbiome. The mycelial landscapes, networks, they don't live by themselves. They select a microbiome of bacteria and other organisms that rest upon the mantle. These fungal networks are the foundation of the food web. Well, similarly, we have a microbiome. And it's really interesting that the many of the bacterial diseases that infect fungi also infect us. Our best antibiotics against bacteria come from fungi, penicillin being the obvious example. But we have found now doing next-gen sequencing, and this has never been published before, that the mycelial mats growing in the very same wood chips, in our case, that have been fermented, we had a thousand-fold difference in the relative abundance of genera of bacteria from the very same wood chips, two different mushroom species planted on those wood chips, and the microbiomes that were created and selected for by the mycelium were vastly different. This really strongly supports the concept. This is a hypothesis with quickly becoming a theory. I'll explain the difference in a minute. But this really supports the concept that I've long believed and espoused, that these mycelial networks are not just happenstance. They're creating the habitats and the flora and then ultimately the fauna that are resident within the ecosystem to guarantee the plurality and the biodiversity of the ecosystem by creating the plants that grow up, that feed the animals, the insects, to create the debris fields, and then feed the mycelium for the benefit of the progeny of the mushrooms that will form thereafter. So these are deterministic organisms that are setting the stage for ecological evolution.
And you think that they're doing this in a conscious manner?
Well, see, again, we're a victim of our consciousness trying to define what is conscious right. And what is smart. And one of the best arguments I've had, my brother Bill is a super genius, is far smarter than myself. And he was editing one of my books, Mycelium Running, How Mushrooms Can Help Save the World. And he goes, Paul, you cannot say that mycelium is intelligent. And then he says, you can't say nature is intelligent. I go, wait, Bill, I respect you. But you didn't realize the hypocrisy of the statement that you're giving me? You're telling me nature is not intelligent, and yet you are born of nature, using the mind to conceive the concept, to challenge the idea that nature is not intelligent when you are part of nature? I rest my case.
Yeah, that's indefensible.
So we create language and words to describe concepts.
So you feel like your brother was sort of hampered by these predetermined categories that we like to put things into. You have a word, use that word. The word is very clearly defined in our ideas.
Thank you. Yes. You know, language is code. And we have not elaborated the code yet to elucidate the concepts that we're trying to articulate. That does not mean that just because you can't prove it's true doesn't mean it hasn't happened.
Right.
So as our vocabulary increases, you know, as our lexicon of language increases, it becomes more robust, then I think we can better describe, test, and prove that these concepts are true. But we're biologically provincial. When we think about how limited we are, we're truly Neanderthals with nuclear weapons. I mean, this is when you look at how important natural ecosystems are. Try to replicate them. They're very, very difficult to replicate due to their complexity. So I think the more that we study nature, most all of us scientists subscribe to the adage that the more we study this subject, the more we realize we didn't know. Mm-hmm. And the hubris of us thinking that these things cannot occur, did not occur, will not occur, really speaks to our provincial attitude towards nature.
The idea that these fungi are creating their environment and almost they're the architects of this environment. They're establishing the landscape for all these different creatures and life forms to live is unbelievably fascinating. That the idea that and also that they're connected, right? They're connected in some sort of almost like a neural network. And there's what is that thing in the Pacific Northwest, the one fungus group that's essentially the largest living organism on the face of the earth?
Yeah, the largest organism in the world so far discovered is a mycelial mat 2,200 acres in size, and that's equivalent to about 665 football fields.
And that's one animal.
It's one mycelial mat.
Thing.
One mycelial mat is a honey mushroom that kills trees. It's an edible mushroom. But think of this. I mean, think of so for those listeners out there, if any soil biologists know this well, if you go out and get some nice, rich soil, a gram of it, and you analyze it, there typically is 5 million microbes per gram in that soil. Now, the mycelium is growing out We have five or six skin layers that protect us from an infection. The mycelium only has one cell wall. On the other side of that cell wall are hundreds of millions of microbes per gram that are trying to consume it, many of which the mycelium is able to upregulate in constant biomolecular communication with this ecosystem, be able to prevent predators from consuming it, thus allowing it to achieve the largest mass of any organism in the world. This is amazing to me because it means that it is constantly in communication with the ecosystem, being challenged, accepting alliances. So guilds of microbiomes are being created, selected by the mycelium. And these guilds and communities then cooperate in order to prevent pathogens, parasites, even competing guilds from coming into the landscape. So the dominance of these fungi are to ensure the ecosystems that give lives to their progeny. The rule of natural selection in life is reproduction. So everything steers towards reproduction. So from an evolutionary biology point of view, what will that organism do to help survive so it can reproduce? And reproduction through creating guilds of communities of the microbiome using the mycelial network as the structural foundation of the food web seems to be the name of the game here.
So this honey mushroom, is that what it's called?
Yeah.
And that lives in the Pacific Northwest. How is it killing these trees?
It's a root parasite. So it comes in and it kills the trees. And I spent a lot of time in the old growth forest and a lot of hiking. I've always been wondering about meadows in the subalpine regions. There's all these subalpine forests. And then you come out and there's these giant meadows. Well, I suspect that this honey mushroom is a meadow maker. It climaxes these trees. It kills them. They then die. And then they grow saprophytically, but then it clears the canopy so the grasses landscape.
Saprophytically? What is that?
Saprophytic means it's growing on dead material. So first is a parasite.
Oh, you mean the mushrooms?
The mushrooms. First is a parasite, kills the tree. Then it's a saprophyte, or saprobe is another word for it. It's a decomposer. It breaks down that material. But as it decomposes the wood, 30% of wood becomes water. So the mycelium generates water.
Whoa.
And so water lenses are being created. Now you have more sunlight, grasses then flourish. And so I've suspected that these mushrooms are actually meadow makers, allowing then the elk and the deer and marmots and whatnot to exist in those grassland environments as a way of rebuilding the nitrogen source in the soil. So I think these are over great, huge timescales. We have to get away from the concept of our lifespan, or even 100, 200 years. We need to think in millennial terms, you know, over many, many millennia.
This is unbelievably fascinating. The idea that they're sort of the architects of their ecosystem.
They're the architects of our existence. This is something that there's some really fantastic research that's come out in the past 2 years. I'm a science ambassador for the AAAS, the American Association of Advancement of Science. So I am a little bit out there, but I'm really happy that I have so much scientific support these days because a lot of things I've been talking about for 20 years are now well-rooted and been proven. One of the things that has been so fascinating to me, and I'm still wrapping my mind around this, but you know, the universe was created about 13.8 billion years ago from the Big Bang. The Earth coalesced out of stardust about 4.5 billion. The earliest records of life we have is about 3.8 billion years ago, single-celled organisms. But just recently in lava beds in South Africa, they found mycelium infused through the lava 2.4 billion years ago. Now, we split from fungi 650 million years ago. And then in Brazil this past year, they found a fully intact, apparently a fossilized mushroom published in Nature, which is a very, very reputable scientific journal. And that one is 1.4 billion years old. So the oldest multicellular organism in the fossil record today is this fungus and lava in South Africa 2.4 billion years ago. A fully formed mushroom who had its form was growing 1.4 billion years ago. We separated from fungi 650 million years ago. Mushrooms have had their form longer than we've had our form by more than a billion years.
Here, Jamie just pulled it up on the screen here so we could take a look at it.
The one from Brazil.
This is the Paul, is this the image that you're familiar with?
Yeah, this is the one that's, that has just been published in the past. They have a great name that's a tongue twister to pronounce. It's Gondwana agaricides magnificus.
Why do they do that? Do they do that to make people like me feel stupid? They don't have to.
No, they do that because graduate students want to publish papers and so they can invent names.
So. And so it looks better if you have a long Latin-sounding name.
So, but think of that. Mushrooms had their form before we had ours.
Yeah.
These are elders. These are ancient organisms. These are the overlord underlords of our ecosystem. And I suspect, and as these neural networks, they have more neural connections in the mycelial mass, they're over 1,000 acres, than we have in our brain. They are actually accumulating not only genetic intelligence, but I think that as time goes on, I hope that we will be able to interface with them. Because I think that there is many benefits of us communicating with mycelium that can give us rapid responses to catastrophia. That's how they've evolved. And we're now the biggest walking catastrophe that I know, walking across the planet. And we need to engage these fungal allies for the benefits that we need to put into play in order to prevent the loss of biodiversity.
It seems like a communication gap would be very hard to bridge. The communication gap, I mean, if we really did find a way to communicate in some form with mushrooms, like the concept of language, like you were talking about, just the idea of nature and intelligence and these words that we have these concrete definitions in our head that don't really apply to some things that are very, very confusing to us, like the idea of fungal intelligence, the idea that you could somehow or another understand the language that these things – we don't even understand dolphin language, right?
Well, one classic example, Japanese are so clever at this. There's a slime mold, you know, called Physarium polycephalum. And they had and this slime mold is very, very good at navigating through mazes and challenges. I mean, first the food wins. You know, the conservation of energy, you know, is rewarded.
So how do they set this up? They put a little bit of it.
they did several experiments. The most fun one is they designed a nutrient, basically a nutrient like maize, replicating Tokyo in the Japanese subway system. And so they started with Tokyo, and they put oats, which is a nutritional source. They inoculated what is on this basically kind of agar map with all the major cities, the nodes around Tokyo. And they then made each of those nodes had a piece of oat on them, which was a source of nutrition. The main oat was where Tokyo was. They inoculated it, and then they let the slime mold then grow. And first it grew out randomly, exploratorily, you know, just like you would do if you're a hunter or something. You're hunting on the landscape looking for things. And then after about 28 hours, it reorganized itself in the most efficient way possible and reorganized the Japanese subway system in a more efficient manner than it's designed today. Thus, they said, not me, not Paul Stamets, this is a demonstration of cellular intelligence.
Whoa.
So this is the tip of the proverbial mycelial iceberg, you know. This is has broad implications. And I just want people to suspend their disbelief. And this goes into actually the evolution of human consciousness. And Terence McKenna was a good friend of mine. I love Terence. I especially love him the last 5 years of his life because he made fun of himself so much. People took Terence way too seriously in many levels, but as his brother Dennis, which I think has been on your show.
A couple times.
Yeah, Dennis is a great ally, great scientist. But, you know, Dennis said even if 10% of what Terence said was true, it's friggin' amazing. And Terence and Dennis both came up with a stoned ape theory. Now, it's not a theory, it's a hypothesis. A hypothesis is speculative. But cannot necessarily be as not yet proven. A theory is a hypothesis that has been tested and proven with facts. So I disagree with them in saying it's not a theory, it's a hypothesis. But the hypothesis of the stoned ape, which I think you've alluded to before, is that with climate change and as the savannas increase and our primate ancestors came out of the forest canopies, they're tracking across the savanna. And if you're a hunter, what do you look? You look for footsteps and you look for scat. And the most significant fleshy mushroom going out of poop in Africa, hippopotamus, elephant, you know, deer, antelope, etc., is Psilocybe cubensis. It's a very large mushroom. You're hungry. You're with your clan. You consume it. And then 20 minutes later, you are catapulted in this extraordinary experience. Psilocybin substitutes as serotonin, becomes a better neurotransmitter, activates neurogenesis. It causes new neurons to form, new pathways of knowledge. So that's the stoned ape hypothesis, and it speaks to a mystery that the human brain, basically the brain cavity doubled in size in about 2 million years. Some people say less than 200,000. Homo sapiens
less than 200,000 years?
Yeah. Homo sapiens arrived 200,000 to 300,000 years ago.
That's a big gap, right?
It's a big gap. Well, the science is like that. So you want to be scientifically accurate here, I need to show the extreme margins of what's been estimated. So if we accept 2 million years and it's shown in the fossil record this is true, the oldest Homo sapiens fossils are 300,000 years old now. But we have a suddenly doubling of the human brain, and with that our language centers increased, our ability to prognosticate, to plan. And there's no explanation for this currently, and even though we may not be able to prove it, I ask people to suspend their disbelief for a second. Now think of this. Our primate ancestors are going across the savannah. They ingest these mushrooms as a clan. Massive input for anyone who's eaten these mushrooms. Huge amounts of data is coming in. Fractal patterns, geometrical, landscapes occur. You have empathy. You have greater courage. You're fighting a saber-toothed tiger. One day you have a fear of it. We know now from neurogenesis and the extinction of the fear response that has been clinically proven, psilocybin allows you to reset and have different neurological pathways to respond to fear, overcoming the fear of conditioned response, potentially PTSD, and there's a lot of research on this currently. But this wouldn't happen one time with one hominid group. It wouldn't happen 2 times, 10 times. It happened millions and millions and millions and millions of times over millions and millions of years. This leads to what I think is called, that should be called epigenetic neurogenesis. We know that there's a regeneration of neurons. We know that psilocybin substitutes the serotonin. It opens the floodgates of the senses. You have a lot more data coming in. And we know that you have the extinction of the fear response. So if you're the leader of your clan, you've had this traumatic event, either war or cataclysm from earthquakes, whatever the case may be, or encounter a saber-toothed tiger, whatever. If you're the leader of that clan and you can overcome your fear response, you have courage and you have empathy. Those are leadership skills. I think people should take note of it. People like to follow leaders who are courageous and yet kind, who they can trust. They'll have their best interests in mind. So I think this propelled... I think it's a very good explanation. It's an unprovable hypothesis. But now we're at a junction and we're ready for the next quantum leap in human consciousness. I think psilocybin should be looked upon as a nootropic vitamin. And there's a huge amount of interest in this. Johns Hopkins University, as you probably well know, New York University, UCLA, elsewhere in Europe, there's major clinical studies that have been conducted in the past 2 years showing exactly what I'm saying about overcoming fear response, neurogenesis, overcoming PTSD. This is now medically quite seriously considered and something that I think that we should explore under controlled settings. I'm not into partying with psilocybin mushrooms.
Damn. So good.
I can understand the
Ari Shaffir is going to be here in an hour and a half, and he's the creator of Shroom Fest. Uh-huh. He's going to be very upset with your idea that you shouldn't party with it.
Well, I think there's greater benefit to
yourself
and humanity. I think these are serious tools.
California has it. As I'm sure you're probably aware, it's up for legalization.
Yeah, I was really quite surprised by that.
Yeah.
All my work, and to put some caveats here, all my work is covered by a Drug Enforcement Administration license. I've published now 4 new species in the genus Psilocybe, including the most potent psilocybin mushroom in the world called Psilocybe azurescens. And to be clear, folks, nature provides, I don't. So
Right, of course.
When I had my DEA license, I mean, everyone I suspected was a DEA agent who came to me and wanted to get some psilocybin.
But I'm sure you probably got set up a bunch of times.
Numerous times.
Did you matrix at all?
It was to the point it was pretty funny. You know, I had this one person who offered me just huge amounts of money, and I played with him. And I said, no, it's not enough. And he offered me more and more money, pretty soon about $200,000, $300,000. And he was writing all these coded letters. And it was obviously a DEA agent trying to set me up. And finally got really frustrated because I was playing with a guy. I said, you know, I'm tired of being set up like this. I'm just going to play with a sucker, you know. And so it finally came to a point, and he got really, really frustrated. He's going to get mad at me. He goes, well, how much money? I go, there's not enough money on this planet for me to ever give you a psilocybin mushroom. So give it up.